Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization. And they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us, so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors, because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization, and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. pour libation to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
Welcome, family. Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is your brother Kwasi. We are broadcasting today. Again, this is Warrior's Way production, continuing the fight, and we're part of Black Reality Think Tank. We're affiliated with them and on their network. And we're broadcasting today on Block Talk Radio. That's today, Sunday. We normally do this on a Thursday, so we will be back this Thursday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Again, Warriors Way production, continuing the fight, part of Black Reality Think Tank. We're affiliated with that network, and we're broadcasting today on the Block Talk Radio System. We're going to be on Block Talk Radio System again on this Thursday. Again, we'll be back on the regular time. Today, we are blessed to get going after a couple weeks. We've been off the air, just working on some network difficulties and other situations and stuff, but here we are today. And so hope that works out pretty good for us. Today, this week's program, we're going to talk about the lies in education and the media. That's what the program is going to be focused on. Not being taught the truth keeps us as slaves. Now, we were the first educators, inventors, builders, and scientists of this planet, yet our education does not reflect that truth. And why not? And what are we doing to change? You know, there's talk now, you hear about, what's it called, CRT, critical race theory. You know, I was out on a job site yesterday working security in, out in Slinger, Wisconsin, talked to some people, and actually that conversation came up. And I was talking to a young man about, I wouldn't say young man, he's in his probably 50s, white male. And when he was talking about critical race theory, he got very offended. He did not want to talk about that because he was like, he didn't want to hear anything about George Washington owning slaves or Thomas Jefferson and having sex with raping a nine-year-old and having fathered children by her. He didn't want to hear those kind of things. And is that what we're dealing with, you know, right now when they say critical race theory? I mean, what is that? That's just telling the truth about what happened and what people did. And they don't want to hear that. And so that's a struggle. And so is that why our education system is the way it is now? Because you're avoiding telling people what really happened and what are you doing? You're keeping other people feeling less important, feeling like they are the problem. And they need somebody else to help them. And, you know, you get so much of that. And when I say that, that black people can't help themselves. They need someone else to do it for them. And so I have a problem because I look at people as, here are the creators of the problems, but now they have the solution. But, you know, but we'll get more into that later. I'm very fortunate I have a guest. That's going to be on later on today, Stacey Orr Smith. She's an educational specialist, and so she does a lot of work in urban school systems and just school in general. So we're going to have conversation with her and have some discussion. But before we go any further, I'm going to talk about a number of different things. I'm going to do an ancestral profile. Today I'm going to do one on John Arthur Johnson, nicknamed the Galveston Giant. Now, he was American boxer, the height of the Jim Crow era, became the first American world boxing champion, black champion. Well, he fought in some black organizations, because they did not allow or would not allow blacks to fight whites for the simple fact that the blacks might win and they weren't going to have that. So he was a champion among the black fighters, and we're talking for 2,151 days. That was the longest streak of any color heavyweight, and he fought heavyweight. Now, he wasn't like a large heavyweight, but he was ferocious. He was only 6'1 and 200 pounds. And so when you think about a lot of the heavyweights today, you got your Lennox Lewis, Tyson, I mean, not Tyson Fury, but, well, yeah, he's a heavyweight, but I think close to 300 pounds. Lennox Lewis, 260 pounds. You know, Mike Tyson, 230. And I'm trying to think of the guy that had just lost, Deontay Wilder. He's like 6'7". 260 pounds. And so a lot bigger. And not that there weren't bigger fighters back in that day, because when I'll go on about Jack Johnson. Now, he was widely regarded as one of the most influential boxers of all time. And he was just a dominant champion. In 1910, he fought against James J. Jeffries, and he was dubbed, and that was dubbed the fight of the century. Now, again, Johnson only 201 pounds. You know, he was 6 feet tall, just 6'1 and a quarter, basically. That's what they had him listed. And he won the heavyweight title. And, you know, and that, like I said, in the Jim Crow area was something special. And in the height of his paydays, I think in that fight, he got $113,000. So you're talking about 1908 and $112,000. That's equivalent to, you know, having a couple million dollars today, back then, you know, as far as the value of a dollar. And prior to that, and he went through a lot of difficult things, and you have to understand, white fighters, he had to chase after people to fight them. And the white fighters did not want to fight him because they didn't want to take a chance of losing. And so he chased after Jeffries for years. I mean, and then when I say for years and chased after him, he went from country to country. You know, he followed him like that. And he was making money when he was fighting. He was fighting, and some of his fights he'd get $2,000-$3,000 a night. So that's a lot of money. And I can tell you now from when I used to do some professional fighting, and one of my first fights, tough man, I won $1,000, but that was two nights of fighting. But I did fight some other pro fights and fought some four rounds and six round fights for like basically $100 to $200 a round. So back then he made quite a bit of money in that, and the cost of the value of a dollar was a lot greater than what it is today. Okay, now Johnson, I'm going to go a little more about, you know, just his some of the things he did. In 1912, he was also a businessman. He opened up a successful restaurant and nightclub in Chicago. And that was run by his wife, who was white. And this restaurant was called the Black and Town, Black and Tan restaurant. It was a desegregated bar. So white and black people were in that bar. But that became a problem because, again, we're talking about this was in the height of the Jim Crow era. And so they had problems with Johnson having a white wife. As a matter of fact, he was married multiple times. He was not faithful to his wife. He was not embraced a whole lot by the black community because of his attraction to white women. He did have some relationships with black women, but he married on three different occasions on three different white women, okay? And Johnson, and I'll go back with his boxing, his boxing boxing record. He had 73 wins, 13 losses, 11 draws, and I think he had 3 no contests. Now, Jack Johnson fought until he was 60. That was his last fight at the age of 60. So imagine that, age of 60, that was his last fight. So, and Johnson also, Joe Louis was coming up during his time as a fighter, and Joe Louis's camp wanted Johnson, did not want to associate with Jack Johnson because Johnson was a real flamboyant fighter. They wanted Joe Louis to be low-key. And you have to understand, this was during the height of Jim Crow. So when Johnson fought, and when he beat Jeffries, and that fight is on TV, and the police stopped that fight in the 14th round. He jumped in the ring after Johnson was beating on Jeffries so bad. They stopped the fight, and they cut out some of the television so people couldn't see him get knocked out. It was just no way they were going to let a white man get knocked out. And then on top of all of that, the corners, no matter how bad Johnson was beating up the fighters, these white fighters, they would not throw in the towel. It was just no way that they were going to admit that their fighter could lose to a black person. And so, and Johnson knowing that, knowing that every time he won a fight, beat somebody white, there would be riots in that city and in other places all over, from people being excited about Jack Johnson dominating and beating another white person. And so there would be lynching going on. And Johnson knew that. And he taunted the fighters in the ring. And one of the other things that he did, when he would fight a fighter, he would hold him, hit him so he couldn't fall down, and help him up so that he could continue beating that person. And then he would mock the crowd and say things to the crowd. And then after the fight, he'd get his money, and then he would leave with a white woman. He was well-dressed. He had like the nightclub I was telling you about in Chicago, and he had paintings in that nightclub worth over $15,000. The place was immaculate, with the rails made out of silver. I mean, he just put a lot of money, and he just had a lot of wealth. You know, he bought his mother a house in that area. Like I said, he was an exceptional person. But again, he fought during the worst of times. And when you talk about everything that was going on, and for him to go out in the ring and fight those people, and he got death threats all the time. And matter of fact, at one of his fights, they said that they were going to kill him after his fight, and a person shot and missed Jack Johnson and hit another black male and killed that person. But, you know, like I said, they wanted to see him get beat. They did get him on what you call the Mann Act. And the Mann Act was something they came up with it wouldn't allow you to, for immoral purposes, take a woman across state lines. And so this woman happened to be the white woman that he was seeing, that he eventually married, but she happened to be the daughter of a sheriff out of Milwaukee. And so they sentenced him to a year in prison in Levittown, but prior to that, he fled from them for several years, and that's why he fought out of state. I mean, not out of state, out of the country. So he was fighting in Australia, in London, in different places like that. And eventually he went back, and he served time in prison for about a year. And when he was in prison, he did what he wanted to do. He ate when he wanted to eat. He wasn't like, they didn't treat him like the normal prisoner. He was He had liberties to do what he wanted. He trained the way he wanted. He actually started a boxing program while he was in prison and still did some fighting and stuff, working with people. He was an amazing man, went through a lot of different things. He loved to dress fancy. He wore nice suits, spent a lot of money on his suits, clothing. And he would drive these fancy cars. He loved the speed. Matter of fact, he got pulled over by a sheriff for speeding. And he paid the fine. And and the sheriff said, well, you know, we need you to slow down. He said, well, I'm going to be coming back, so I'm just going to pay you another so much money and stuff because I'm not slowing down. And he gave that deputy some more money, and he just took off, continued speeding. So he was very a dominant person, did what he wanted to do despite everything that was going on. And I'm going to tell you something. They made a movie about him called The Great White Hope, and James Earl Jones played Jack Johnson in that movie. And Muhammad Ali went to go see that movie. And he saw that movie, and he went back after the movie and talked to James Earl Jones and said, hey, that's my story. That's my story. And, the difference in this story. One, Ali got arrested basically for not going to Vietnam. Jack Johnson basically for having relationships with white women. That's not Ali, but the circumstances of how they took his title away from him. They didn't beat him in the ring. They beat him outside of the ring. And so that's what he meant in that regard. And so you can see the similarities when we're talking about the oppression that we go through, you know, as the black people, you know, and that's a very difficult thing. And under those circumstances, they held their hands up high, and they weathered through it, and they fought like no other, you know. And so when they say we stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, here are two giants. We could go on and on about Jack Johnson, Muhammad Ali, I mean, the things that they've done. And I'm going to tell you another thing about Jack Johnson. He tried to help Joe Louis. Before Joe Louis fought Max Smelly, he told Joe Louis, he asked for Joe Louis' camp before he fought Max Smelly, and he said, "Let me work with Jack because with Joe Louis." And Louis's handlers didn't want that to happen. They didn't want that to happen because they did not like. Jack Johnson's flamboyant ways. They didn't want Joe Louis to be associated with him, and they didn't want him to look up to somebody like that. So he didn't go. So he wouldn't let Jack Johnson help him with his training. So Jack Johnson told everybody before the fight. That Max Smelly was going to win and told him how he was going to win. You know, told him he was going to, you know, because the way Joe Louis fights, you know, he keeps his left hand low and he's going to counter him with a right hand and left hook, basically, and that's just what happened. He got knocked out in the fight. And so, and then sometime after that, Jack Johnson did go to Joe Louis's camp. And he went to Joe Louis's camp, and he's up there in age. I think he's in his 60s at that point. He's at Joe Louis's camp, and he gets in the ring, and he tells one of the coaches, says, get me your fastest fighter. And they put some little lightweight guy that's pretty fast, and they put him in the ring with Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson walks over to the corner of the ring, and he stands there in that corner, and then he just tells the guy, come on, give me what you got. stayed in the ring with a guy for several rounds, and the guy never landed a punch. Never landed a punch. And I can go on to tell you something, and this will tell you something in itself. James Jeffries, that was knocked out by Jack Johnson. And so this is a white man. This was their great white hope. And Jeffries said this in his loss to Jack Johnson. And this is what he said about his opponent. And these are his words. I could have never whipped Johnson at my best. I couldn't have hit him. No, I couldn't have reached him in 1,000 years. And so that was the respect that someone that ran from him for years wouldn't give him an opportunity to fight, but he made, to make a statement like that during the height of the Jim Crow era and white supremacy, to say something like that about a fighter. So Jack Johnson was a remarkable, remarkable person, and it was just amazing what he accomplished. So Jack Johnson, he lived till he was 68 years old. He passed away in a traffic accident. He was speeding. There was no conversation as to whether his brakes went bad or there was something suspicious. It just said traffic accident. And this was June 10th of 1946. Again, he was 68 years old, and this was in Franklin, North Carolina. And he was buried in the Graceland Cemetery in Chicago. So if you ever get a chance to stop there, that would be, I didn't know that myself, so I most definitely could go there. Now, he was also, I told you he was a businessman. He had the restaurant, tavern. But he also worked on an invention. He made a wrench, and he had that patented. He was also received an award. It's called the Anfield Wolf Book Award. Anfield Wolf Book Award. Now, it's an American literary award dedicated to honoring American people that have written works that have made important contributions to the understanding of racism and the appreciation of rich diversity of human culture. And that was something that was established by Anfield Wolf in 1935, and she was a poet. And so, again, Jack Johnson received that award. And it's John Arthur Johnson is his name. And the Galveston Giant was his nickname. That's what he was called. And, I'll go over his fight record, 73 wins. I'm sorry, 13 losses. And 38 KOs, 11 draws. And again, he fought up until he was 60 years old. 60 years old now. I did fight in my early 50s. If I could, I feel comfortable enough at 60. But again, Jack Johnson, we're about the same size. I'm 6'1¼", and that's what he was. I'm a little heavier, but, I saw some film of Jack Johnson, and from everything I've seen and watched, I mean, he was just an amazing person. His skill set level and the things that he was able to do was just amazing. So that was our ancestral profile. I'm going to talk a little bit about the ACLU. And now that's the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation. And I'm doing this because, you know, I saw something recently. And this is on a Liddell Lee. Now, this young man was executed in Arkansas, and he had a death sentence. They believed he was innocent. They knew that they could prove it. And I'll just read what happened here. Lindell Lee's longtime claim that she was innocent of a 1993 murder. The recent development is happening about 4 years after Mr. Lee was executed by lethal injection in Arkansas for the murder of 26-year-old Deborah Reese, a white woman. Mr. Lee was proclaimed his innocence for more than two decades, from the time he was accused and later charged until his death in 2017. Now, the judge in the trial and the district attorney refused to allow the DNA test before executing Mr. Lee. Now, these advocates say that the DNA evidence in the case points to someone other than Mr. Lee having committed the murder. Now, since Lindell's execution, the ACLU has discovered a wealth of new evidence to supporting the claim of innocence and said that Nina Morrison, senior litigation and counsel of the Innocence Project, is in a joint process release. All of the evidence should have been presented to the court while Lindell was still alive. But it wasn't, because he couldn't afford a quality defense. Now, we know that 167 people have been exonerated from death row for crimes they did not commit, many after losing decades of their life behind bars. Now, the lack of thoroughness in Liddell's investigation helps explain the long And we hope the court will allow us to finally uncover the truth. Now, this is something that happens, and we can talk about this over and over about so many cases. But that's what we're dealing with the system that we're in today. I see so much of that. I've seen it in my career as a law enforcement officer. I did almost 25 years, and I was the first black officer hired in the suburb Cudahy, Wisconsin. That was back in 1989. There is still not another black officer. There's not one in the surrounding suburban areas. There's not one in St. Francis or South Milwaukee, and I don't believe that there will be. And I know how they feel about us, because they let that be known by the way they treat or especially me. I was basically forced out. I physically stopped people from doing some of the things that they weren't supposed to be doing. And I did that and paid the price for it. Now, I wasn't alone. There were other officers that saw things that shouldn't be going on, and they tried to stop it. But you couldn't have a black man going over someone white and correcting them. And, you know, so they had to do something with me in that regard, you know. So, yeah. So that's what we're dealing with right now. And let me get back to where I was. I lost sight of my view for a second. The program's off. I'm back here now. Okay. So, I'm going to see if we're going to talk like the program on the lies in education in the media. And, you know, like right now they're talking about, I mentioned the critical race theory. And to me, all that is basically just telling the truth about it, going on and stuff like that. So I'm going to have Stacey Orr Smith accompanying this conversation. And so hopefully she comes on. She should be on pretty soon. So I'm going to try and see if I can reach her and get her on. Since, you know, what's going on is we're on, like I said, a different network. And so we're trying to work out the kinks here and there, and the kinks on our end as far as figuring out how this system works. Again, this is Warriors Way Production, Continuing the Fight, affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank Network, and we're broadcasting on the Block Talk Radio system. Now, we're doing it today on a Sunday, but generally we do it on Thursday. And that's from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. So that's what we're looking to do. And as soon as I get my guests on, we'll get into the conversation. And she's an educational specialist. I'll let her give her background and so she could shed some more light on this situation. Because there is issues with what's going on in our system, how our kids are being educated or not educated. You know, I remember back when that movie Hidden Figures came out, and that was where those young ladies developed the formula for Apollo rocket to make it to the moon and stuff, and we found that out. And then all of a sudden, science people that got involved with the science and understanding that, wow, we actually did those things. It brought just some more empowerment and insight to our people, you know. And history does that. But when you don't know and you believe some of the information that they're putting out about you, you know, that you're not qualified or you're lacking, then you respond a certain way. And so the truth is important. I think a lot of people have discovered that the truth is important. We need to know those things. And so many people will distort the truth and for their own personal benefit. And that's been going on. And like even when we talk today, when we say distortion of the truth, when you talk about some of the things in recent events, when we talk about the elections, and where I'm talking about the presidential election that just passed with former President Trump and the newly elected President Joe Biden. And they're still saying that that election was a fraud. No matter what they've done to prove otherwise, they're still holding on to that. And so when we think about people holding on to lies and the damage that it causes, you know, you have people that believe and when I say people, I'm talking about a lot of Black people. I know a lot of Black people that don't feel good about themselves, don't feel good about being around other Black people, and they believe a lot of the stereotypes that are being said about Black people. And they're just beat up. And that's from years of abuse from... And we can go back from slavery. And those were times when we were held hostage. We were kidnapped from our homeland. And they, you know, kept us in a situation where, you know, it was difficult for us to learn under the circumstances in which we, under what they were teaching, what we needed to learn. Because we came here with our language, but then they taught us their language. But it was a difficult time. But again, when we talk, and I made a comment, you know, in the beginning, you're looking, I say we were the first inventors, builders, scientists of the planet, educators. We were the first parents, protectors, all of those things. And you got to understand, you know, when you talk, think about Africa, we harvest the land. And so the land was plentiful with food and everything, and we knew how to do all those things. And they knew that when we were captured and brought back here. So we were brought here for, you know, for our wealth of knowledge for harvesting the land, among other things. You know, the things that were built, you know, they blew the noses, Napoleon blew the noses off the pyramids and the lips and stuff because there were figures of black faces. You know, and so it's just so much out there. And so right now, when they talk education, they want a certain belief to be out there and to dominate the conversation. And we're just trying to change it. And we have to do that with putting the information of the truth. We have to tell our story. There's a movie that came out as an HBO special, man. I would ask all the listeners here to look at it. It's called Exterminating the Brute. I saw that. I watched it once, and I'm looking to watch it again. Very good documentary, and it just talks about the history and things that were done. And I'm not saying there's a lot of people that really don't know, that really, honestly, don't know the truth. And so when they talk about critical race theory, that's one of the things that some of these people that are protesting about political race theory and not wanting that to be taught in the schools because they don't want to make white people feel guilty or have trauma over what their ancestor did to gain the wealth and knowledge that they've gained and the advantage that they have over people today. They don't want that knowledge to be out there. So that's a discussion that we're looking to have. That's more critical than the people, the other people. But again, we're going to be at the top of the hour. And so I am going to get to a song I'm going to do for top of the hour and just looking for that. We'll get to that in a second, and then we'll no, that is not. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Roger. Yeah.
question to me. If you want the best, you put me to the test, and I'm sure you can agree that I got no flaws, cause I'm down by law when it comes to rocking viciously, you see, cause of when I was a little baby boy, my mama gave me your brand new toy, two turntables, a with a mic, and I learned to rock like a Dolomite. Time went by on this God creation, I knew someday I would rock the nation, so I made up my mind just what to do, and I joined with the Jam On production group, so go crazy, go crazy, so don't let your body be lazy, I said don't stop, the body rock till your eyesight starts to get hazy. Clean out your ears and you open your eyes. If you wanna hear the music, just come alive. If you don't know how, get ready to learn. Cause Cosmo's taking his turn to burn.
Take the seat, you know when it's easy.
Okay, I think I'm back on. Okay, again, we were going to have a guest, Stacey Orr Smith. Something came up where she wasn't able to show up. So we can continue this specific conversation. Again, we'll welcome callers to call in at 516-418-5674. That is 516-418-5674. This is Warriors Way Production, continuing the fight, affiliate of the Black Reality Think Network, and we are operating on Blog Talk Radio System Network. And we will be back this week on Thursday at a regular time from 6 p.m. to 8. That's what we usually do, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Thursdays. When we did this changeover, there was some mix-up throughout the week, so we weren't going to it was going to be on a different time, but we just didn't have enough time to get that information out to our listeners. So hopefully we had enough people that listened to the show tonight that find out that we are still on, just on a different network. But again, we're going to be continuing this fight. We're going to talk about, you know, our education system, and I had an educational specialist in regards to the conversations that wanted to have tonight. But I'm also going to just kind of also bring up a another topic that I'm going to be talking about this Thursday. I'm just going to kind of go into it somewhat. I was telling you earlier, before I got off the line, before break, that I had a conversation with a former Milwaukee detective. Now, he solved over several hundred homicide incidents in the city of Milwaukee throughout his 25 years. And, you know, during our conversation, you know, he had made a point in saying that we're a little different, myself and him, because of decisions that we made, how we live our life. And he kind of alluded to some of the other people that aren't as fortunate because they made poor decisions by choice. And I told him that there's some truth in those things, and there's also some serious attempts and ways that are ingrained into our system of how we teach people and how we treat people as to why they do the things that they do. And we can go on and on, and I'm not doing a blame game where I'm saying, but at the same time, you can't take or discount some of the bad things that happen. And so that's the argument that we're having right now with critical race theory, because you have people that don't want to acknowledge what they did, what their ancestors did, and what the system in place is still continuing to do to generate their wealth of knowledge and education and financial means and everything, and what they do to keep others down. And not to have that conversation and not to expose those differences and the way people are being treated, and doesn't make sense. And I think that it keeps us in a place where we feel lost and hopeless. And I say that's why a lot of people today, black people, don't want to be around other black people, because they feel that their lives are in danger. You know, the quality of a relationship or the location where you might live, it's just not going to be good. It is going to be better when you live in an area that's predominantly white and you happen to be that fortunate one that is able to move away from that black neighborhood and move into this white area. But then when you deal with all this, all these issues where, you know, your kids grow up, and you might be at a point in your life where you're comfortable and you feel that you can handle things pretty good because this is where you are. You're an adult. You're a well-established adult. But you have kids. You have a family. And you have maybe a 10-year-old kid. And they're being battered all the time mentally and socially. You know, every time they turn the TV on, you know, they don't see anything that resembles them in a positive way. When they go to school, when they talk about things and they see other people and other students, they don't see other students that look like them, that reflect a positive image. And then when they do talk about people that are black and brown, they talk about them in a negative type of way. And so how does that power a person? Well, it doesn't. And we know that. And that's something that's always been known with our educational system, psychologically and physically pound you into submission. And we no longer have the chains and the whips on us, but we are mentally beaten up. And so many people have given up, and they don't care. And when you don't care about yourself, and that comes from a place of not knowing. So if you don't know who you are and you let other people define you, tell you who you are, and they're telling you a lie, and this is what you believe, then you're going to be in a bad place. And I think that's what we're dealing with. And so when you talk about the violence in the city of Milwaukee or anywhere, and that has to do with a number of different things. And I think one of the things is, and I'm talking from a parent point of view, I'm talking from a professional fighter, as an instructor in the martial arts and the martial sciences of dealing with different types of conflict and crisis. And we tell people as men, and there's a macho-ness in how we think we need to deal with things. And I heard this when I was a young kid, and I never understood this, but I heard people say this in conversations when I was a little kid and I was hanging out with some older kids. So when I was 10 years old, I was around some other kids that were 13 and 14 years old. Now, at 10 years old, I was just as big as some of the 13 and 14-year-olds. So I could hang with them, and they didn't really always know how young I was. But I would hear people talk, and they would say certain things. Well, my dad told me, if somebody try to fight me, don't run. Fight them back. And I don't care how many of them it is. You're not going to run. You know, and if somebody pull a gun on you, you tell them they better use it. You know, and I've been around enough. I'm 60 years old. I've come up in a lot of situations. I've been very blessed to still be here, but I know many of people that I came up with, they were involved in different type of crisis, and things that they said made it worse. Things that they did made it worse. And a lot of the reasons they said and did the things that they did at that time was the advice that they were given. And they were given advice from their parents or other people that they looked up to. And is that what we're dealing with today? Are we giving good advice, telling these people how to deal with crisis? You know, one of the things that I see, we don't own the guns. We don't make the guns. We don't make the ammo. But people talk to you to this day, and they tell you right now, and I just left one of my cousin's house, and she was just showing me a gun she just picked up a gun. And I was showing her how she needs to, I said, if she had to aim a gun, and I took the gun away from her, and because she kept it, one in the chamber, and safety was on, and I took it, and made sure the gun was clear and everything, and I showed her how she needed to aim the gun and how she needed to walk with it, and if she did have to use it, how she should carry it and all these different things. And after giving the gun back to her, I put it back the way she had it, when she had one in the chamber and the magazine back in the gun, and I gave her the gun. She dropped it on the floor. The gun was made well enough where it didn't go off. It's, you know, some of them have a hair-sensitive trigger where they go off, but that wasn't the case, so that was a point. But she dropped the gun. That could have been some accident, and, you know, and bullets travel, and she had a round or a ball ammunition, so no hollow point. And I was telling her the difference from that and the hollow point. You could hit somebody with that ball ammunition. It's going to ricochet, or it can go straight out the body and hit somebody else, you know, versus the hollow point, you know, it explodes on contact and opens up and mushrooms out and stuff like that. And so that's why, you know, mostly law enforcement, when they have those hollow points so that they don't have those ricochets and so forth. Now, the problem is if they hit the wrong person, you know, the amount of damage that it does. Ball ammunition we basically use for target practice and training issues, things of that nature. But then again, she has a gun now, and she's been in situations and so forth where she feels she needs to protect herself, so now she has a gun. And she's in her early 40s, early 40s. And so considering, and she's pretty mature and has a good understanding, so it's not like today where some of these young kids at 14 and 15 and even younger are walking around with guns. And I know when I was a young kid, when we were learning how to protect ourselves and the advice I was given from my father, you know, sometimes they would teach us how to box. Actually, my dad didn't teach me anything about boxing. All he told me was if somebody hits me, to hit them back. And not to let anybody pick on me and never give up. But that just wasn't enough information. And so I would look around and I would see kids that knew, that I grew up with, that knew how to fight. And I knew they had learned something. Maybe they watched TV and they learned from that way. And when people tell you you can't learn from watching, yeah, you can. You can. Now, the reality and the truth in the matter comes down when you actually get into a situation and then you meet what we call that moment of truth. For everything that you think you know and you tried to do when you were just working out, shadow boxing, and then you actually get into a real situation, you know, somebody actually hits you, how well you recover from getting hit, how well you take that punch, and what can you do once you get hit? Are you going to keep going? Are you going to keep fighting? Are you going to become more aggressive, or are you just going to fold up and just hope that they stop? I've seen those things happen. But again, that's why it should be some type of manhood training where we teach people that, and when I do martial arts, like one of the things that we teach people, the first line of defense, and if I ask you to tell me what your first line of defense would be for your kid, your son and daughter, say they're walking down the street and these three guys or four guys or two guys or two big guys and they're a lot bigger than your kid and stuff, and what are you going to tell them? Well, you know, their house is down the block and they need to get past this way. And, you know, I'm going to tell them to cross the street or I'm going to tell them to run, go somewhere, get on the phone, call me, do whatever. I do not want them getting into a situation where they're in a fight with somebody and more than likely lose, but how bad someone gets hurt, whether they live through it or get crippled or lose a body part, I don't know. But those are the type of things that people are doing to people for much of no reason at all. And so we basically tell people in martial arts, your first line of defense is run. And then we tell them the second line of defense is run faster. And so fighting is something that you do when you have exhausted all other alternatives. Now, those things can happen immediately. And when I say that, if somebody walks up to you, asks you what time it is, and you look at your watch, and then all of a sudden they put a knife to your neck. You need to be doing something. You need to be backing away. You need to knock that knife off their hand, hit them, do this, do whatever. But if you stand there and you freeze and you do nothing, then that increases the opportunity that they can puncture you with that and do some other things. But to react with motion and do something, you have to train that way. So this is why we believe in training and teaching. And I know that works because I've been trained in the combat, and I've been able to save myself and other people, and it's because of the things that I've learned. When I was on the job as a police officer, I used deadly force once in a situation. Someone tried to, they turned off a light, and I was going down the basement, down the steps. I had my gun out, and I had my flashlight out, and this person had threatened to kill his roommate. And prior to that, he had tried to kill his sister and his mother in another suburb in Madison. And as I was coming down the steps, he ran at me, and he had a scalpel in his hand, and he swung it at me. And I shot him. I was like, when I got to my second step from the top of the stairs, That's when he ran up and said, I'm going to get, and then that's when I shot. He went down. I shot one time, didn't have to do anything else, and he was down and he was done. You hear a lot of people talk about when you shoot, you in the law enforcement, they tell you that, when you shoot, you never know how many times you shot because you're in an emotional state where you just boom, 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 boom. You keep shooting until the threat is over. Well, I knew the threat was over when I shot one time, so I didn't shoot 8 more times. You know, at that time we carried 45, so actually it was, 8 plus 1 in the chamber, so that was 8 more times. And so I had 9 rounds. I only shot one time. Like I said, I knew the threat was over. And this, again, when I was a police officer, and I'm telling you this as a police officer from that point of view, because they tell you that you make these split-second decisions and you don't know what you're doing under that stress. Well, I knew exactly what I was doing up under that stress. Matter of fact, when I had that shoot in that situation, I told my bosses before I even got down to the top of the steps. And I do, with my martial arts training, I do meditation, I do a lot of different things. But as I was going down the steps, I could smell this guy. I could smell him breathing. I could hear. I could smell the sweat coming from his head. So I knew he was down there. And my body was just so in tune to his smell and listening to even hearing his breath. And so I knew he was down there. And before I got to that second step, I hit the light. And the same time I hit the light, I had turned my light on, knowing that that light probably wasn't going to come on. That's just how I felt. And then he ran, and he was trying to say, I'm going to get. And he never got that other word out before I shot. And I hit him. He went down. The other officers, I had a partner that was still in another person's house because he felt that everything was clear and there was no longer a threat. I didn't feel that way. But long and short of it, after I shot, my partner came down to see what was on, and he saw the guy had slid down the steps. There was a dog in the house, and there was a dog brush on the floor. And so my command showed up on the scene, and so they're looking around at this guy, and they see a dog brush on the floor. And I told him what happened. I told him that I heard this guy. He said, I could hear, I could tell he was downstairs. I could smell him. You know, I said all these things, and they just kind of looked at me funny. I told him I heard something scrape the wall, and that was him swinging a knife and the scalpel. And then I shot. Later on, after the coroners got there, they removed the body because prior to that, all they saw was a dog brush on the floor. So they figured I shot a guy because he had a dog brush. So I was in trouble. So when the coroners got there and they removed the body, that's when they saw the scalpel. Then after they removed the body, they looked on the side of the wall and they saw the scrape from the scalpel on the wall. So now everything I said fell into place. Now, I wasn't worried about that because I told them what happened and I wasn't trying to make anything up. You know, I just said what happened. And, you know, and the truth is going to stay with you. You don't have to remember the truth. That's going to stay with you. What you have to work on is remembering a lie, which is what so many people do. And so so in my situation, again, I shot one time. I knew the threat was over. I was very clear and precise as to my account of what took place. And usually when an officer is involved in an officer shooting, especially in a suburban municipality, they go and they speak on it at the MATCs in the area or the local college campuses where they have police training, and you tell about your story. Well, my story did not fit the narrative, and it didn't fit the narrative because I was a black officer and I shot and killed a white person. And there were a couple other officers involved in some other situations after me and before me. Both of those officers were white, and both of the people they shot and killed were black. And neither one of those black officers, I mean, black suspects in the matter had a weapon or anything like that. But, again, they felt threatened, and they shot multiple times. I shot one time. And so there's a reason why I believe that they didn't have me go out there and speak. One, it didn't fit the narrative that black people are so dangerous and such a threat to law enforcement. And if you look at the numbers, I think it is 70% or a little higher, 70% of the officers that are killed by, I think it's 77% or something like that, are killed by white assailants. But again, black people are listed as number one as far as being the most dangerous threat to law enforcement. And so that is just a narrative that we really need to work on trying to change. And so when I'm talking about self-defense, and let me just tell you another story real quick about this incident. The mother of the man that I shot and killed in that incident, she called the station and said, "I hope that officer is okay. I just want him to know that I knew he had to do what he had to do because he tried to kill me and my daughter, his sister, you know, a year ago in Madison, and they shot him with less than lethal force. And so she just wanted to make sure that I was okay, and she wanted me to know that. And so I just wanted to share that with you. Again, my story did not fit the narrative, and so there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about that, because again, you want to promote that the people of color are the most dangerous threat out there. And so again, you have a lot of black people fearing black people, so they don't want to have these conversations. And when you look at how we engage with each other and with all the little cliches and things that they come out where you need closure and you need transformation, just so many different catchphrases that they use to promote different programs. And the bottom line is we just don't have the social engagement that we used to have, because they have changed the system in which how we used to communicate with each other. And we used to play and wrestle with each other physically all the time, but a lot of that contact, you have to sign a contract when you go to school now saying that you're not going to do certain things, because they don't want you to have this type of contact. And then this is even more emphasized, you know, with COVID and stuff. You know, so, you know, now with COVID restrictions, you're staying a certain distance apart. You're just not engaging with each other the way you used to. But again, beside that going on, prior to that, we still had issues with homicide in our black and brown communities, among black and brown people that felt that they needed to handle crisis using deadly force. So you had a lot of people underage or people that were of age. Some of them had guns legally. Some of them had guns illegally, but they used them to kill other people for senseless reasons. There was an incident where a grown adult, thinking in his 30s, and this was on the news, he killed his 5-year-old son because he ate a piece of cake that was left over, and he hit the 5-year-old and killed him. You know, so he's serving time for that. But again, we have a lot of people that just aren't wired right. They believe that they need to handle what they handle with extreme violence. You know, they don't know how to do – they don't have different gears. I have a friend of mine, when I say that, he only has one speed. He only goes all out. He doesn't know how to work with people in a way where you're not going to hurt them. So – I make sure if I have him do something with somebody, when I used to have him work with my students at my school doing martial arts, I didn't have him sparring with people. I might have him, sometimes he could do defense where he just covers up, but other than that, I couldn't have him swinging back at people because he doesn't know how not to hurt people. And, you know, he does everything like it's an assault against him and his life is in jeopardy. And some people have that type of mind frame when they get into a situation. And sometimes that's how they've been taught. You know, their parents are telling them to hit them as hard as you can. And I know, I tell you, in martial arts, in karate, we tell the young ladies when they get into a fight, we tell them that hit them as hard as you can. And one of the reasons we tell them that because a lot of girls aren't as aggressive as a lot of guys for obvious reasons. And so when they do get into a situation, and if you throw a shot and it's real light and easy, somebody may counter you with something really hard and you're done. And, you know, it's different when somebody hits you and they knock you down and they leave you alone, but that's not what's going on. We see little kids that are hit and they're knocked down and then you got another kid or a couple other kids, they're kicking the kid in the head, they're jumping up, stomping on them, or they're grabbing something, kicking them with. And I've heard parents tell their kids, if, you know, somebody's bigger than you, to tell you to grab something up, pick a brick up, pick a rock up. So if they're in school, they got a book. They're going to hit them with a thick book. They're going to stab them with a pen, a ruler, a pencil, or something like that. But are we passing on that information? Are we passing on that kind of violence to our kids? Is that what's going on? Is that why we're seeing the upswing in violence in our neighborhoods against black and brown people? Don't we know how to talk and engage with people? Hey, I didn't mean it. We don't need to fight. I'm not going to fight you. I'm just going to walk away. Is there a problem with seeing things like that? Does that make you a coward? And to some people, and I've heard this many times, and I'm sure you've heard it, look, man, I ain't no punk. And, you know, and what does that mean? I would rather see my kids come home at the end of the night versus reading about him and people pouring bottles of wine, you know, toasting to him, saying, oh, he wasn't a punk. He went out and, you know, and I'm like, I've heard that. I've heard that many a time. I did a lot of volunteer work in the Milwaukee Public Schools. And I've been around kids one day and then over the weekend, somebody's dead. And then I hear the kids talk about how that person died. And one of the things that they say, he wasn't no punk. And they brag about that. And so to some people, that's a badge of honor. And then for other people, they're just not wired right. And when I say they're not wired right, the value that they have on their life, they don't. So people that don't value their own life, they certainly don't value other people. And there was I was talking to one of my good friends, sister, Mentha Bolton, and she was telling me about a young man in his early 30s that was robbed a couple weeks ago here in Milwaukee. And the guy took his money, took his jewelry, the guy gave him everything he wanted, and still shot and killed him. And that is just such a common thing that happens. And so I try to teach people, you know, when you get a chance to stop a person, there's nothing wrong with you stopping somebody from trying to hurt you. And I'll just use this example, not to say that you're that person with a gun or anything like that, but I'm just using this as an example. if two people have a gun and one, and you're pointing it at each other, you're right, you're real close, and if you're looking at a life and death situation, do you say, you go first, then I'll go? I mean, of course not. You're not waiting for or giving somebody an opportunity to do those things, especially when you see that there is a threat there. And that is an imminent threat that means more than likely that there's a good chance that you won't survive. Now, let's say it's not that situation where both of you have this or that, but you have some training and understanding of what to do in situations. And I'm going to give you an example. I had a friend of mine, and I teach gun retention and gun defense. Gun retention is teaching somebody how keeping it so somebody can't take your gun from you. Gun defense is when somebody has a gun and you take that gun from that person. And so I try not to miss an opportunity on training and teaching. And I had a friend of mine that's one of my students, and he worked at a nightclub as a DJ. Well, he still does. Long and short of it, he went to a nightclub, and he's working, and a guy walks in there with an AR-15 and a 357 Magnum. Now, this white male that walks in there, the two bouncers are fighting with him trying to get the long rifle from him, which is the AR-15, and they call Marcus over for help. And Marcus runs over there, and people are running out of the club, and the police are outside of the place, but they're not coming in because, you know, they have to get their intelligence, and they don't necessarily believe all the information they get from the people that are coming out. Long and short of it, Marcus did what he was trained to do. He grabbed the guy's wrist, turned the gun right on the guy, right away. So right away, the guy's thinking, I don't want to shoot myself. Plus, he broke the guy's wrist and took the gun from him. Marcus ended up getting a citizen's warrant from the police department, and then the club gave him a little something for what he did. That was a very fortunate situation. Marcus happens to be a black male. He works in a predominantly white club in the city, and the police officers that showed up, we've had incidents in other places where police officers showed up where a black male has taken a gun from somebody that was shooting or shot the shooter in situations, and that person was killed by the police. So in Marcus' situation, that didn't happen. So I'm just so happy and thankful in that regards. But that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with some violence, and violence comes in so many different directions. You know, when I say black and brown people, how we live among each other, and we believe so much of the hatred that they're putting, that we are such bad people. And, you know, and I just don't see that. Yes, I see that there's some people that need some help, but I am in the community on a daily basis, working with people, talking with people. And there's pretty much not anybody that I can't go up to and just have a conversation with. And I don't force myself on anybody. I mean, because if somebody doesn't want to deal with you in this moment or they're in a bad way in that moment, then, you know, I'm going to leave them be. But, you know, my door is open where if they show that they are willing to come and talk, then, hey, I'm there. You know, but again, you don't force yourself on people. And then there are some people, like I said, they're not wired right. And if you can't figure certain things out and you don't want to put yourself in harm's way, I'm not going to go in a place and if I got little kids and bring them with me to try to talk to some people about peace, knowing that somebody can might take advantage of me and my kids in those situations and stuff like that. So I'm not going to put them out in harm's way. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do something where I don't have to worry about a whole bunch of other people. And if I do have other people with me, those are other people that are qualified in understanding what they need to do to protect themselves if the worst possible thing happens. And so that's one of the things that I tell people when they go out there and they protest or they go in their neighborhoods and they try to be peacemakers. You know, the Black Panthers did that back in the 60s and 70s. And they would go into a lot of these neighborhoods and they would talk, and we had a common enemy at that time, the police and just a lot of the white supremacist ways that the system is set up. And we also had some people that were confused as to what they should be doing, where they were dealing drugs and they were on drugs and they weren't right with themselves, not understanding who they are, that they come from greatness, that they just feel that they're bad people, and so they did bad things. So we had people that, like I said, didn't know themselves because they didn't know their history. They don't know that they come from greatness. So they've been battered and beaten and given up on themselves. And there's been many people that have learned things and about who they really are and have made drastic changes and have done some positive things. And, you know, and we look at that and we hear stories about entertainers that have been through some of the worst of times, but yet they kept at it and here they are. And so I can go with 50 Cent. I can't think of what his real name is, but there's many of people. Snoop Dogg, Ice-T, and I remember he did the song Colors. And when I was on the police department, people would talk about that as, oh, we hate that guy because he made that song Colors talking about cop killers and all that. But I'm like, in L.A., Los Angeles, that was one of the most corrupt departments in the country and still is. And they were part of drug trafficking. You had a lot of officers from the patrol level to command, lieutenants and captains, that were part of the drug trafficking and had even killed other officers for the sake of money. And that was in the papers back in the 90s. And so I had pulled some of those articles, and you can look that stuff up. So anytime I give some information out, and I hope you do your due diligence and look these things up, because one of the things when I was in law enforcement, I used to teach these classes, conflict resolution skills, and I used to work gangs, and I used to do the Midwest gangs throughout, in the Midwest through Wisconsin. So I would hit those areas, like I said, Wisconsin. And so Detroit was one of the places we went to. So I go there and deal with their gang and crimes unit, and we would call them specific STGs, specific threat groups. And so that went from your your street games, like what you would say, Latin Kings, Gangster Disciples, to your Hells Angels or outlaw biker gangs and so forth, or, you know, mafia people. Everybody, there was nobody. And white supremacist groups and stuff like that. So, I mean, you had all those different groups that, you know, I dealt with a lot of those different situations and stuff. So my experience, a lot of it comes to jobs. Some of it comes from just my life experience. So I've been around and involved in a lot of different organizations. They helped me learn and move me in the direction that I'm going now. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is being on the broadcast, and I've done several shows, and they've done pretty well, and I've been mentored so much by Dr. Will Rogers, Brother Alfonso Watkins, Dr. Janie James, Queen Mother Sabini Shabaka, and just so many different people, Sister Mentha, Bolton Bakari, Kutaju. So I can go on and on. I have a wealth of people that I have conversations with that bring some things up that I may not be aware of and put some, give me just some more information, some things I need to research. And, you know, there's a good thing with having that connection with your elders, and I think that's also a problem with our young people right now is because they don't have their connection with their elders, you know, and that is that African-centric way of thinking and growing that we don't have. And we don't have that because we were born into this European way of thinking and doing. And so we are out of sync with ourselves because of that, from an educational standpoint to spiritual and emotional. And so we need to learn about our ways and do the things that we need to do and how we came up. And so this is part of that critical race theory. This is one of the things that I was hoping that we were going to be talking about tonight. I am not an educational specialist. And so I went to schools. I went to college. I went a couple of years, got my associates, and then finished up the Chippewa Valley in Eau Claire. Went to recruit school out there and got into law enforcement. And so I did that for almost 25 years. And just worked a number of different jobs and got a lot of different training, different things when I was on the police department. So I understand a lot when it comes down to law enforcement, and also a lot of the jobs that I worked in the inner city, and just my experiences just growing up. It's just been a plus. And then from me traveling all over the world from fighting, I won a number of different world titles, but just seeing how people live in other places is an eye-opener, and it makes you wonder why people do things so different in one place versus another, or why some things are the same. And so that exposure to these things helps you grow. And so, like, I've been very fortunate to be around a lot of people that have shared some information with me. I'm at a point in my life where I can, you know, absorb that information and make some good decisions on, you know, the good and the bad. You know, like you said, you get some information, everything you get, you know, like I said, you want to research, do your own work. You know, you can't be spoon-fed. You hear some things and, you know, don't just take it for what they say, you know, but research, do your homework, you know. So that's what I would suggest that you do, and that's what we want to do when we put these shows on. This week, Thursday, I'm going to do a show, and I haven't titled it yet. I will title it probably tomorrow, but I'm going to talk about the violence in the community and how we are teaching and preaching our young people, and are we contributing to that by what we're doing or what we're not doing. And so I think that's going to be an important something because, like I said, there's a lot of people that have antidotes. It's how you deal with violence. And I think the antidote that most people are using is not the best way. And most people are talking about violence with violence. You know, when I grew up as a young kid, and it's different for a lot of these kids today, because when I grew up as a kid, I didn't have to worry about guns from other kids so much. That wasn't a worry. But today it is. And I know so much of that because, you know, I still work some of the bar scenes. My son was at a bar. He's old enough where he goes to the clubs at night. And there was a young man that was killed on the same night that he was at a different bar, but he knows the kid that was killed. And basically what happened in this bar, this kid got into a verbal altercation about a basketball game. And they made this other kid leave the bar. And he happened to be a firefighter in some city somewhere else. But he came back to the bar at Bar Souls, and this other guy happened to be a black male. He was a very popular kid, and he had hit this other guy. And when he saw the kid outside the bar at Bar Closing, he said, "Look, I'm sorry I hit you. I tell you what, you go ahead and you hit me back." And, you know, he put his hands behind his back and said, "Go ahead." And the guy then looked at him and said, "I don't want to hit you. I want to kill you." And then he shot him and killed him. And, you know, that was just... what rose to that level? So here's a guy, there was an argument, I think this argument happened at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. 3-4 hours later, this guy is waiting outside the bar when the bar closes, waits for this guy to come out, and then he confronts him, and then he shoots and kills him. And so we really have to think about how we look at violence and how we look at solutions. So that's one of the things that we're going to talk about this Thursday on Warriors Way Production, Continuing the Fight. This is your brother Kwasi Shuja Kowatu. I mean myself. Now, Kwasi Shuja Kowatu means warrior for the people. That's in Swahili. So that keeps me kind of in a good place where I know that what I'm doing is not just me, it is for my people. And so I'm trying to do all I can to help the people. And so, again, so this Thursday, 6 o'clock, this is going to be Warriors Way Production, Continuing the Fight. We are affiliates of the Black Reality Think Tank Network, and will be on Blog Talk Radio System Network this Thursday. That call number is going to be 516-418-5674. So thank you for the listening, and we'll see you next time.